Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast. I'm Brian Gibberman, joined by Sports Illustrated's Rob Mahoney. Rob, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And free agency is pretty much basically over, besides waiting on how much the Cavaliers are going to pay certain people. I think everyone else is pretty much done all their major lifting at this point. So let's start with the most recent trade that's happened. The Rockets acquired Ty Lawson from the Nuggets. I think from the Rockets' perspective, it's pretty obvious what's going on there. The Nuggets has a little bit more nuance to it. What do you think of the direction that the Nuggets are going right now?
I think it's understandable, given the way that things kind of turned out with Ty Lawson. They've been in an interesting place over the last couple of years. I'm not a fan of every move they make. There's certainly a level of dysfunction there in terms of the direction of the team, in terms of who are the dominant voices there. It's a really interesting franchise in a lot of ways. That said, you know, as far as where they are right now and with the pieces they have right now and the resources they have right now, I think they can do a lot worse. I'm fine with extending Danilo Gallinari and Wilson Chandler. I'm fine with bringing in Jameer Nelson as kind of, you know, a steady hand as a backup type while Emmanuel Mudiay comes into his own. You know, the Ty Lawson thing, you know, he was basically their most valuable asset as the best player on the roster, and to have his value crater so quickly, I can understand why people might have wanted them to wait that process out, but this is a team that really needs to establish some kind of forward momentum. Bringing in Mike Malone to be the coach for the first time this coming season, I think this is probably the right time to do that.
They have a ton of draft picks going forward also, so do you think they're kind of what they have built up already makes it a little bit more okay that they're kind of trying to balance being decent right now, re-signing the veterans versus going full-blown rebuild to acquire even more draft picks? I think they have the rights to 4 or 5 next year.
Yeah. I think they're in a good spot, obviously, with the picks they've acquired. You know, the right to swap with New York probably being the best asset of the bunch. Although, you know, it's maybe kind of a toss-up in the end in terms of which team between Denver and New York ends up having the worst record. But the other picks, you know, that Memphis pick, I think in particular, is interesting. You know, just because the West is so volatile, Mike Conley's going to be a free agent next year. You know, one Marc Gasol injury and that team could go in a really bad way. And it's protected as such that it's probably not going to convey this year unless things go really, really weird for Memphis. So, you know, that's one to watch. I think they're owed a pick from Houston, as a result of this deal. As far as I understand, it's lottery protected, so it's, you know, looking at something in the 20s probably for this year, which is fine. And then that pick from Portland as a result of the Aaron Aflalo deal, that's probably going to convey, you know, almost certainly going to convey as 2 second-rounders given where Portland is. So, you know, they've got a little chest of assets that they can deal with, that they can pick with, they can do whatever they want with. But yeah, with the value of the rookie scale, especially against an exploding salary cap, I think that it's certainly a nice place to be when you have these little pieces to move around.
All right, so with Houston, I mean, they got to the I get the defensive concerns with Lawson and Harden, and then you also have Beverly to mix and match with them. But, I mean, they got to the Western Conference Finals last year basically playing Jason Terry and Pablo Prigioni. It's not like those guys are anything special on the defensive end. What are your biggest worries and concerns about the Lawson-Harden pairing, and why do you think it should be effective?
I mean, I don't have any kind of big picture concerns really beyond what you've already described, other than the fact that Lawson really just kind of needs to get his life in order before we start talking about this in a basketball context. So that's
very true. Yeah.
Item 1A on the agenda is Lawson getting to a place where he can contribute to this organization as a professional, getting to a place where as a person he's in a much healthier state. And so provided that those things can happen, and I think that the Rockets are clearly confident that they can, you know, in terms of a basketball fit, you know, I think we run a risk in terms of this kind of analysis, and especially when we're looking at kind of snap takes right after the trades happen and really trying to figure out where all these pieces are going to fit together, where we too often let perfect be the enemy of good, or in this case, perfect be the enemy of an improvement. Whereas you said, when you're upgrading from Jason Terry and Pablo Prigioni to Ty Lawson, sure, Lawson in some ways is not the perfect James Harden kind of counterpoint. You know, that would be, I guess, a version of Patrick Beverly that's even better at what Beverly's already good at. You know, an elite perimeter defender at the point guard spot, just a complete knockdown shooter at the spot, and that would be great. But in lieu of that, you have a guy who can help create offense for your second unit, who can help spell and relieve James Harden at those times where the offense gets stagnant, who fits their style of play so perfectly and is going to run really well with guys like Corey Brewer and Trevor Ariza, and even some of their bigs who are able to run the floor really well, Clint Capella, Terrence Jones, even Donatas Mata-Yunus. I think he just works so well with what they want to do and with the rhythms of their offense, and I think could really feed into things there in Houston in a really positive way.
All right, sticking in the state of Texas, San Antonio, the Spurs, I mean, most people, whatever you want to call them, a winner or whatever, they did really good this offseason. What do you kind of think has to happen there for them to maximize the roster they put together?
I mean, there are a couple things to watch for sure. One of them being what kind of player is Tony Parker going to be, just because he's had some weird injuries over the last couple seasons that have not always made him the most effective in that spot. And he doesn't have to be a superstar kind of player. He doesn't have to be a Finals MVP caliber player. He just needs to be able to fill his role and fill minutes and be the kind of floor general that offense needs. And I think he can do that, but at the same time, you know, aging point guards who rely on their athleticism and rely on their quickness, there's always kind of a watch there. So I think Parker's one guy in particular that I'm kind of looking out for to see what role he's going to play there, and by extension, you know, how ready Patty Mills is going to be to maybe absorb some additional opportunity, because I think he fits what they're trying to do really well in terms of offsetting guys like Kawhi Leonard or LaMarcus Aldridge on the offensive end. Just a really nice shot creator, a really nice shooter who could balance their games really well. You know, obviously the rim protection, which I think a lot of people have broached in terms of, you know, that they just don't have a lot of guys who are center size, who are big-time rim protectors beyond Duncan at this point. Moving Tiago Splitter hurts them a little bit in that regard. I think it's probably an overblown concern, just because I think they're going to cover the floor so well that meeting guys at the rim is not necessarily going to be a backbreaker for them. And I think that's where Aldridge's defense is probably a little underserved. There were times in Portland where he wasn't the most committed, where he wasn't completely dialed in, but I think we've seen that when his teams are going well and when he's in a position where he's encouraged and incentivized to be a good defender, he's very good. I think, you know, probably a little underrated on that in terms of his ability to move his feet, in terms of the versatility and pick and roll coverages he can be involved in terms of the types of guys he can guard. I think he could do really well for them. And so, you know, offensively, there's going to be an adjustment in terms of his game, in terms of the Spurs and how they absorb him into what they do. Ultimately, I think it's going to be pretty fantastic to watch by season's end, and I would expect them to be one of the best offenses in the league. Defensively, you know, there may be a couple more pitfalls, but I still think, I mean, this is going to be a championship contender, full stop. It's just a matter of how they measure up with those other teams in the West and potentially whoever comes out of the East.
I might as well just stick in the state of Texas and finish it off with the Mavs. The DeAndre Jordan thing happened. They've kind of been doing what they've done the past couple of years, where they're just picking up what they consider undervalued pieces and trying to just kind of make a weird fit of players and sneak into the playoffs type thing. They're going along. How much longer are they going to keep going along this path? Is it going to be basically until Dirk retires and then they move on, or do you think they're going to still keep trying this way of building?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know, just because, you know, as of a few weeks ago, that wasn't really their plan. You know, when they had DeAndre Jordan's commitment in hand, you know, I think they had a pretty clear idea of what kind of team they were going to be this year, and more importantly, what their future plans were going to look like in terms of building a core around Jordan, Chandler Parsons, Wesley Matthews as kind of being the core guys there to transition beyond Dirk. And so, yeah, when you lose DeAndre Jordan, you know, you can say whatever you want about him as a player and his limitations, but he was a huge piece for them in terms of how this team was building, and they've had to really rally in a way that, I mean, they're desperate. There's no way around that fact. And so what they've been able to do, again, is like they do this better than almost any team in the league in terms of finding pieces on the fly who can fit to form a competitive basketball team. They're excellent at that. But we've seen, of course, some of their problems come to roost in terms of how they've been drafting and disregarding the draft and trading away picks and moving down in the draft in recent years. I think they did fine this year in terms of getting Justin Anderson, who looks to be an interesting fit for them and a nice piece on the perimeter. But, you know, the health of Chandler Parsons and Wesley Matthews is just so difficult, and so difficult to project, especially in Matthews' case, where it's hard to know exactly where this team is going to be even in a few months, much less next year.
a team that could be taking the Mavericks' place in the playoffs. The Oklahoma City Thunder went 45-37 last year, despite all the injuries that they dealt with, especially with their best three players. I get there's value in points and rebounds, and sometimes we disregard that. But in Enes Kanter's case, do you think it's all worth it with how he fits in with what Oklahoma City already has?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, when we look at players versus their contracts and exactly what the value proposition there is going to be, I think it's really tempting to do just kind of that vacuum analysis. And in some sense, that, you know, that works. But with, for a team like the Thunder, who wouldn't have the means to replace a player like Kanter, who have already, you know, sunk some of the cost in the way in acquiring him at the deadline and giving up pieces to actually get him in the first place, I think that this is really the move that they had to make. I think he's, you know, it's a lot of money. I'm not the biggest Enes Kanter fan in the world. I think he, you know, we saw some nice things in terms of him working off of Russell Westbrook in the pick and roll and in the post last season, but we really haven't seen what this Thunder team is going to look like because Durant was out for so long and then Westbrook was out for stretches. And then Kanter, of course, was only on the team for a portion of the season. And so to see how all three of those guys are going to work together, and then Ibaka had his injuries too, of course, which really complicate Kanter's defensive deficiencies. So to see how everything works, I think is certainly a nice go for the Thunder at this point. It's really their only option in terms of filling out their front court, in terms of finding a guy of that caliber who can contribute in the ways that Kanter can as a scorer and rebounder. And I think that deal's going to be movable. I just don't see it as being, you know, it's a big contract. Maybe it's a problem depending on how you view the Thunder's relationship to the luxury tax. It's not one that I would love to be paying, but when you're in a team in the Thunder's position where you're that close to championship contention, I don't think it's really prudent to let guys like Kanter walk just for the sake of you know, balking at a deal that you might think is a little too rich.
So you're not in the corner of they could have just let him go and they would have been better off playing McGarry, Steven Adams, and some versions of small ball?
No. I mean, I certainly would like to see the Thunder experiment with small ball a little more. I think anyone who's watched Kevin Durant's career to this point is probably in that camp, just because he seems capable physically of kind of holding up to that. But you talk to any of the guys who have made that 3-4 transition on any kind of regular basis about the toll it takes on your body, and this just doesn't seem like the ideal time for that, with Durant's, you know, his foot issues already being so well documented, so much of an issue for him in the Thunder last season, and you saw what it cost them in terms of the playoff berth. So, you know, it would be great to see him more full-time. I am, you know, I like Mitch McGarry fine. I like Steven Adams fine. I would not feel extremely comfortable with those guys and Serge Ibaka being really the only functional bigs on my roster outside of Nick Collison. I think you need another guy to fill some minutes there. And, I mean, this is really kind of what people have been asking for a long time alongside Westbrook and Durant, is another guy who can create in a different way. And, you know, maybe there was some overlap there with Harden that needed to be prioritized differently, that needed to be maximized differently, and you know, that's a whole different conversation, probably a whole different podcast in terms of what happened there. But
yeah, we can stay away from that.
Right, but Kanter, you know, I think Kanter is a really strong player in specific ways, and if the Thunder can maximize those, and if they can tether him to Serge Ibaka in the rotation and try to take away as much of what he can't do defensively, or at least disguise it and hide it, then they're still going to be in a good place. I mean, this is still one of the better teams in the West, provided that everyone's healthy and going. I don't think Kanter takes away from that.
Okay, we're just kind of speedballing through everything here. Let's do one more team before we hit the East. The Clippers. Do we have to take back all our mean things everyone said about Doc the GM with what he did this offseason?
I mean, there's certainly an amendment there, right? Just because this was a team that did not have the means to acquire players who are this good. They didn't seem like they were going to be in a position to leverage the few assets they did have. Maybe the first and foremost of which was Jamal Crawford's contract, which is non-guaranteed up to a point, which they ended up keeping, and instead flipped guys who, depending on how you evaluate Matt Barnes and Spencer Hawes, I think they are borderline assets. I think that some people would consider Spencer Hawes' deal to be a negative asset, one that you would have to, you know, attach something to get rid of in some cases, that they were able to get a guy who, you know, Lance Stephenson, I'm not incredibly bullish on. You know, I think there were certainly some caveats to even his best games and his best stretches in Indiana. But the caliber of talent there and what he could potentially give you is just so much beyond what the Clippers could have reasonably expected. that it made sense for them to roll the dice and to get him in there, to get the guys that they've got at the minimum. I think Josh Smith in particular was just a terrific signing. But even, you know, Cole Aldrich and Wesley Johnson are guys who I think fit what they do really well and give them the kinds of flexibility and the kinds of security and the rotation that they want. To get all that, to get DeAndre back, to pull in Paul Pierce, who, you know, can play some three or some four for them, depending on how they want to roll. You know, they have a lot of nice options. You know, Doc's done a really good job with, as I said before, with, you know, really menial salary cap exceptions and really menial trade assets, and been able to turn that into a pretty interesting roster.
With Rivers, Crawford, and Lance Stephenson all coming off the bench now, it would seem it might make sense to try and flip Crawford into a more prototypical point guard type player, that they don't really need his shot creation anymore, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, the tough thing there is just that Rivers' shot comes and goes a little bit and is definitely a little steadier in spot-up situations than it is off the dribble. And then Stephenson has really never been, you know, any kind of reliable jump shooter. So of the three, you know, it may hurt to lose Crawford in some ways just because, you know, the Clippers' spacing and the flow of their offense is generally great. They've been one of the most efficient offensive teams in the league for a couple years running now. But when you're running lineups with bigs that are pretty interior dependent, you know, Blake Griffin definitely stretches the floor a little bit, and he can work the high post as a passer and things like that. But when you're playing two bigs together in any kind of conventional lineup, I think that's where you may see things hurt if you trade a guy like Crawford away, just in terms of having another shooter on the floor. That said, having Paul Pierce alleviates that in some ways, and Josh Smith, in a sense, if you trust his threes, like, you know, Houston did it and really paid off for them. You know, I think those could be some interesting options that could alleviate the need for a shooter like Crawford. But, you know, I'm sure they'll shop around, as they have been for a while now. I just don't know that Crawford's really going to have that lucrative of a market right now.
All right, in the East, the Atlanta Hawks lost Damari Carroll. They got Tim Hardaway Jr. and Justin Holloway to try and kind of find a cheap way of replacing what Carroll brought. How much do you think they drop off with Carroll out of the picture?
I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on what Tabo Cephalosha is able to give them and if he can be as good over an even longer term as he was last season, where, you know, in some ways, Tabo was an even better fit for the Hawks' best lineups than Carroll was last year in terms of the way those lineups performed, in terms of their overall efficiency, in terms of the way that the Hawks want to play. I think Tabo worked out really, really well. But again, you know, with his injury, with where he's going to be, and just a matter of the fact that he's not always been the most consistent shooter from the perimeter, there's some skepticism there, some reasonable skepticism, and certainly getting, you know, not having the ability to re-sign Damari Carroll, you know, by way of not having his full bird rights hurt the Hawks, you know, in a big way here, no matter what. I mean, I think they've rallied pretty well. I like Justin Holliday as a guy to kind of take a flyer on. I like, the you know, Tabo's ability to potentially plug that hole. I'm not crazy about the Tim Hardaway Jr. pickup, but I can understand where they're coming from given the confidence they have in their developmental systems in Atlanta. So it really comes down to, you know, how much are you really giving up there and how much the Hawks can kind of recreate in piecemeal a player like Carroll, given that they really kind of pulled Carroll's shot along to begin with and cemented him as the player that he turned out to be. I think they're going to be fine, and I think especially bringing back Millsap was so important. I think adding Tiago Splitter is going to help a lot in terms of rounding out that front court rotation. I mean, I think the Hawks are going to be pretty good. They're going to regress a little bit in terms of just wins and losses. I think they were a little hot last season relative to their efficiency projections, but, you know, they're still going to be a really good team and one of the better ones in the East.
So I'm looking through, and I'm just looking at the standings from last year and thinking about what each of these teams in the East did, and it's honestly kind of boring. Not much that then, like, the West, there was like, oh, okay, this would be fun to talk about. I think the team that jumps out at me the most is the Pacers. How difficult of a process do you think it is for them that they're based for them to kind of completely change their style of play?
I mean, we'll see, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that we really haven't seen Frank Vogel in a variety of contexts yet. I think he's a really smart coach. I like what he does in a big picture sense. I like the attitude and the culture that he brings to a team, and even from just, you know, kind of micro level X's and O's, I think that the Pacers do a lot of good stuff. It's just a matter of, you know, how will he take to a completely different look, because we can look at the way the Pacers have played in the past and say, oh, Roy Hibbert really was only on the floor for this many minutes. They really only had these huge, you know, size advantages in these particular matchups. but there was an ethos there. There was an understanding of how that team was going to play and how all the pieces fit together that has radically changed. And some of that is as simple as, you know, when you bring in a guy like Monte Ellis, you are transforming what you were previously doing in a really dramatic way. I like the fit with Monte. He may be a little redundant with Rodney Stuckey, but I kind of like the pieces, the way the pieces fit on the perimeter. Of course, the front court is anyone's guess in terms of what you get from guys like Miles Turner in year one, how capable, you know, Jan Mahimi really isn't a starting caliber center necessarily, but he may be fine as kind of a placeholder in a conference that is still just kind of okay in terms of, you know, how the Pacers are going to pan out in the East. It's tricky. It's difficult. There are justifiable reasons why the Pacers want to go even smaller and really want to kind of push Paul George into that role as a stretch four. No matter how reluctant he may be, it's just really hard to gauge. I'm not envious of their situation in any respect.
The Ellis George Hill pairing, that's probably the most logical backcourt he's been a part of in his career. Based on how skill sets fit together, right?
Yeah, I mean, this has been just kind of an awesome offseason for two particular guys who are very difficult to fit. And one of them is Monte, and the other one's Greg Monroe, who they have very specific skill sets who have to be built around in very particular ways. And yet, to sandwich Monte, you know, in a perimeter rotation in between Paul George and George Hill, potentially, depending on where George ends up playing the majority of his minutes. To have a point guard who can shoot threes, who can defend one and two, who doesn't need the ball to be effective, but can be a supplementary playmaker, and in Paul George have another guy who you can trust to take the ball out of Monte's hands on those nights where Monte's running a little wild and can step in to really defend the best at any position 1-4 on a nightly basis. And, you know, they can really hide Monte wherever they need to. And there are going to be some nights where that's just not possible given how complete some of the lineups in the NBA are. But to give yourself that luxury, I think the only thing that Indiana is really missing in terms of filling out what Monte does and maximizing what he does is you would like maybe, interestingly enough, a David West type in terms of a pick and roll big, somebody who he can really work off of there. And maybe they're hoping Turner can be that guy. Maybe they're hoping that, you know, Lavoie Allen could blossom into that kind of player. I don't know. But for where they are right now, I really like the way that Monte fits into the context of the team.
No, they basically need what they're hoping Miles Turner is going to be 3 years from now, which is probably why their ceiling's a little bit limited here. I get you brought up the Bucks. Do you think they have enough shooting to really make it all work, or does that worry you a little bit?
Probably not yet, and some of that is just, you know, we have this concept that guys like Giannis Antetokounmpo or Michael Carter-Williams, that they need work on their jumpers, but I don't think a lot of people, you know, you look at the numbers and you dig into where these guys are making and missing, and it's pretty disastrous. They're just non-shooters from three-point range right now. And so it's one thing to have guys who, you know, come in at 32-33% but are willing to put up jumpers, and another thing entirely when you're dealing with 18% or 21% or 25%, which is kind of where this rotation is right now. And that's Jabari Parker too, in terms of they just don't have a lot of guys on the perimeter who can hit shots. That's going to be uncomfortable for Greg Monroe in some ways, but I think defensively they work so well to disguise what Monroe's issues on that end could potentially be. And then in terms of the motion and the balance of the offense, I still like the ways that Monroe could play off of those guys to at least have an interesting season. I don't think they're really challenging for anything of import just yet. But it's a nice foundation, and it's a nice step to be able to say, okay, this is what we have now. Now we go about, you know, hopefully really refining the jumpers of the guys that we do have or bring in shooters from the outside, whatever we need to do to kind of fill out the rotation.
I think one of the teams that didn't get to the playoffs last year that really wants to make a push and maybe try and compete with a team like the Bucks, the Detroit Pistons. Were you in the camp that you were, and I know from talking to you in previous podcasts that you aren't a huge Reggie Jackson fan, but are you okay with the deal they gave him, or were you completely against it?
He's not my preference of point guard, just in terms of the way he plays, in terms of how he stacks up relative to his contemporaries at his position. But when you've already made the move to acquire him, you've already gone through the 1 year tender with Greg Monroe, and you understand just kind of how awkward that can put you in, what kind of awkward position it can put you in as a team, where, you know, Greg Monroe, when he's on that 1 year deal, has to approve any trade that he's in. If Reggie Jackson, who you just dealt, again, actual assets for, decides to go the same route, then you're really stuck, and you're relying then on Brandon Jennings to come back in a big way, or you're relying on next year's point guard market to be fruitful in a way that this year's wasn't. I think given that they really already made this decision, you can argue with the figure, you can argue with the fact that they didn't necessarily use restricted free agency to their advantage, but I do think that there is a bigger picture payoff in taking care of quote-unquote your guys and the guys that you have targeted and the guys that you've invested in, the guys that you've set. These are the people that we want to build around. And so given that the Pistons really already kind of made that call when they acquired Jackson at the deadline, I don't have any problem with them following through with that plan, even if the contract, I understand the sticker shock in terms of how people have reacted to that deal.
As I've watched him more, I kind of fell into your camp with Jackson, but this situation with the type of team that's been constructed, it's similar to Monta in Indiana. Like if any team was going to pay him, this is at least the team that made sense with what they're trying to do offensively.
Yeah, I mean, and you can see kind of the outline of something there. And really, it's no fault of Jackson's to say that he's only, in my eyes, just a pretty good player. I think he's a pretty good starter. I think he's fine. It's just, there are other ways to maximize your room under the cap, to maximize the money you could be spending, to maximize the way you go about navigating the trade market that I would prefer. But yeah, I don't have any problem with Jackson being there in terms of the context of what the Pistons are trying to build. And he certainly helps a guy like Andre Drummond, or even last season, Greg Monroe, in situations where it was only one of the two bigs on the floor. If you can space the floor, if you can give Jackson room to work, he certainly has that interesting in-between game where he can squeeze through tight spaces, where he can finish around the rim just well enough to be a quality player for them.
All right, Miami Heat bench units featuring Gerald Green and Amari Stoudemire, over-under defensive rating 155.
Oh man, it's gonna be fun to watch. Just because I think a lot of people who weren't watching Amari closely over the last couple of years are appraised of just how bad he's been lately in that regard. And he's always been a guy who, when you look at even the per 36 numbers, who can contribute and can put up some stats, who can get you some points and rebounds, who can score with relative efficiency, depending on what you ask him to do. It's so tough to build functional defensive units with him at the five, unless you have a guy at the four who can really cover up a lot of what he's doing. And, a healthy Bosch is a guy who can fill some of that void, and really that's all that he will need to do. These aren't going to be big minute lineups for them. I don't have any conception that Stoudemire is going to be playing a ton, given, at least what they seem to like in Whiteside, and if Bosch is healthy, and if McRoberts is coming back, and even Chris Anderson, they have options. And Amari's a nice piece to have. And the Gerald Green deal, for all of his defensive problems or defensive disinterest, really, to get him at that price, I think is just pretty outstanding.
He just kind of runs around and does whatever he wants. It's pretty funny to watch. He kind of tries, but he just has no purpose with the defensive scheme and just kind of floats around. It's like you sit there and if you just watch Gerald Green play defense, it's really weird. I don't know if I've ever seen someone like him. Let's see. Where else? Are the Wizards the second best team in the East? If you were to pick one, is that where you would go?
I don't know. I think losing Paul Pierce is going to hurt them a bit. I like some of the things they've done to rally, but now we know that Jared Dudley is going to have surgery, going to be out for a couple of months. That kind of dings their chances a little bit in terms of where they're going to stack up. They still kind of need to figure out how to best use Nene at this point. I don't know whether he's better used as a bench guy, nor do I think they really have the flexibility to do that full time. I think their best lineups can stack up with some of the better teams in the East for sure. But I think I still trust a team like Chicago to finish better than them, to be a little bit more playoff viable than them. Yeah, I don't know that I'm quite ready to put them as the second best team in the East.
I wish Wall didn't get hurt last year. I would have really liked to seen how that team did in a series at full strength against Atlanta. That would have been fun. Do you have anything you would like? I've talked about the Knicks enough. The Bulls didn't really do much. I think we covered enough with all these teams going on here. Is there anything left from free agency that really jumped out at you that you'd like to touch on?
Nothing in particular. I mean, the market was, of course, pretty crazy. I'm really curious to see what next year looks like, given you know, the number of guys who took long-term deals and how sparse next year's free agent market is really starting to look once you get beyond Kevin Durant and, you know, maybe Al Horford and Mike Conley, or, you know, depending on what you think of Joakim Noah at this point, there's going to be so much cap space to spend, and some of those mid-tier guys I think are gonna have really nice summers next year. So this is a weird omen in a lot of ways, but, you know, this is going to be a really fascinating season and hopefully an even weirder summer next time around.
That the teams that didn't spend money this summer are but most of them have. I mean, most of them have pretty much filled out their rosters. You kind of had to, because I did the same thing as you. I looked through next year, and my first thought, I was like, oh, no. Like, what the heck is going to happen next summer? It almost seems like teams aren't going to be able to fill out the necessary cap space that they need to.
Yeah, and that's maybe where a team like Philadelphia, who, while I generally appreciate the Sixers' long-term process, and I understand that, you know, if you have an ownership group who is willing to be patient, that this is a pretty smart way to rebuild, even with some of the bad breaks that they've had. But the Sixers just really haven't spent any money this summer. You know, they've had one, you know, minimum free agent signing in Pierre Jackson, essentially, or I guess now they have Scotty Wilbekin too, off their summer league team. But really, you're talking about minimum salary guys with a team that, again, is going to be pushing for the salary cap floor, maybe. And you know, it's a harder sell, and it's one of those things where it's easier said than done to say, oh, the Sixers should have signed somebody. And when you really get into it and start looking at the candidates of who would make sense, who's young enough, who could they get in a long-term deal enough, who would they not have to just significantly overpay to entice them to come play for a Sixers team that isn't complete. But at the same time, like we've been talking about, I think the teams that haven't taken advantage of the fact that everything really is kind of play money right now, with the way that the cap is set to explode, those teams that locked, you know, young or even youngish players into 4- and 5-year deals, I think could end up seeing some pretty significant returns from that. And that's where a guy that I know we've also talked about in the past, Brandon Knight, who I like Brandon Knight, but I'm not the biggest fan of his game. But to get him on a long-term deal like the Suns did at a pretty reasonable number, I think those are the kinds of contracts that I think are going to appreciate in value and really start to pay off for those teams that made those long-term investments.
Especially, and I'm on the same page as you with Knight. I'm not the biggest fan, but I do see why the Suns did it. He's 23 and there's still room for growth there, so something like that this summer definitely made sense. All right, now your website, it took me forever, but I finally stopped typing in cnnsi.com, and now I just type si.com. Like, it stopped it started sending me to Bleacher Report, and I used to get mad. It took me like 6 months to get used to just typing si.com. Do you got anything up there that you want people to see?
Nothing in particular right now. Just did a piece on Kristaps Porzingis earlier this week. There should be something coming up later this week on the Suns that may or may not be up by the time this podcast ends up rolling out. But yeah, just check around. We got a lot of stuff going on from Summer League, from kind of bigger picture free agency stuff, and then of course, you know, as we move into to previewing the season.
I'm in the midst of writing a Suns story right now. I think I'm all in on that team. I think they're actually going to be really, really good.
I think they've done a really nice job. And, you know, with an offseason that I think caught a lot of people off guard, and even some of the minor moves they made, you know, just kind of waiting around with just the right amount of cap space and just the right amount of time to jump on guys like Mirza Teletovic, even as kind of more of a minor addition in conjunction with their bigger moves this summer. But, you know, they're going to be right in the thick of things in the West for one of those final spots. I'm still kind of sorting out and trying to digest in terms of, okay, we know that Oklahoma City is going to be in the mix for the playoffs. We can peg, you know, Portland and maybe Dallas to fall out, or at least Dallas to be more of an open question, and figuring out, you know, between Utah and Phoenix and Dallas, and I don't know what your confidence level in the Pelicans is, but how those four teams could potentially shake into two spots. It's really tough to sort out right now. Those teams did a nice job in terms of making that really competitive.
I think, yeah, I mean, Anthony Davis is there, so you have to put them in the mix, but the Pelicans also had sort of a weird offseason. Teletovic, it wasn't, as I butchered his name as I was saying that, Mirza, I'll just go by his first name, like, that was a small move, but that was really exactly what the Suns needed coming off their bench. That couldn't have been more perfect.
Yeah, especially in a summer where, you know, they dumped a couple of guys into the Pistons cap space, and, you know, you could say that they need a three who can shoot, or they need guys who can fill these specific roles, but Mirza is essentially the better version of those guys that they traded. And so to you know, get rid of the salary that you needed to make a competitive rental in Marcus Aldridge, and they were very much in that conversation and in his consideration, to be a part of that, to have room for some of these younger guys to step into bigger roles, to get Tyson Chandler an upgrade, what was probably the biggest need on the roster. Sorry, Alex Len, but yeah, I think they're in a really nice place.
Yeah, and then Len, still only 22, has time to keep developing. He was solid as last year, but I mean, Tyson's a very clear upgrade on him, and they seem to be headed in the right direction. All right, go to SI.com, check out all Rob Mahoney's stuff. He does a really great job. Rob, thank you very much, and that wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast.